Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments in Brown versus De La Cruz from the petitioner.
Please the court. In 1995, section 5.102 of the Texas Property Code was added by the Senate bill that sought to deal with problems in the colonies and would be applicable only in a small number of states, a small number of counties throughout the state. The broad question in this case is when should Texas courts create or imply a private cause of action when the underlying statute does not expressly contain it? A narrower version of that same question is whether Texas courts should imply a private cause of action in this instance. We contend that there is no private cause of action in this instance and should be none for basically eight reasons. The first of these is that the express language of the statute creates only a public cause of action. The language subject to a penalty has not been construed by any Texas courts, has not been construed the best that I can find by any court in the country. However, it seems apparent that the reason for that is subject to a penalty clearly implies a public cause of action. And unless there is more to the language, then a private individual has no right to enforce that penalty.
Would there be
by
anything?
Public cause of action, you mean the state attorney general or state prosecutor, wherever that resides?
The state wherever that resides. And it could reside with the attorney general, it could reside with the county attorney, or district attorney, depending upon the cause of action and other enabling statutes that may exist.
So the attorney general could file the same suit and impose the same penalty. Is there anything standing in the way? I mean, to rule that yes, it is a public cause of action, not a private cause of action before the statute was amended. I presume you agree that it's a private cause of action after the statute's been amended.
I would agree with that,
okay.
Yes.
So if it's before the statute was amended, is there anything that would keep the Attorney General from now pursuing this claim on behalf of Mr. De La Cruz?
Other than potential limitations, I don't believe there is.
So you just care who you pay it to?
We care who we pay it to, and we care whether or not the person who is imposing that penalty has given any prosecutorial discretion. The amount of the penalty, the size of the penalty in this case, is outrageous compared to the conduct, and it's solely due to the passage of time. And we think a public cause of action always brings with it prosecutorial discretion. For that reason, we feel that the public cause of action was intended and should be applied in this case. The second reason that we believe there's no private cause of action is the legislative history clearly indicates that no private cause of action was intended. There's nothing in the 1995 legislation, nor in the 2001 legislation in terms of legislative history, that indicates that in 1995 there was an intention to create a private cause of action. And in fact, there are things in the legislative history that indicate that it was not intended. The most significant of these is in the 2001 bill analysis for Senate Bill 198 in the 77th legislature. The bill analysis says that this section provides that a seller who violates subsection A, which requires giving the deed within 30 days of the last payment, seller who violates subsection A is liable to the purchaser, rather than subject to a penalty for liquidated damages and reasonable attorney's fees. There are three things in there that are important in terms of legislative history. The first is the language rather than. Rather than means and not, in contradistinction to something other than. It's not this, it's this. And we say when you say it's not this any longer and now it's this, that that shows that the 2001 amendment brought in a new regulatory scheme. The second thing that this bill analysis shows is that we go from the language of penalty implying a private cause of action, I'm sorry, a public cause of action, to liquidated damages implying a private cause of action. The difference between a penalty and liquidated damages is important because in the context of a penalty, If the person to be penalized dies, the cause of action abates as to those penalties. It ends. As to liquidated damages, the cause of action would survive against the estate of the person being regulated. So we have a substantial difference simply by the change in terminology from penalty to liquidated damages. And finally, in the bill analysis, we see, and in the language of the statute, we see a provision for reasonable attorney's fees. We don't see that in 1995. One of the reasons we don't see that in 1995 is the government code already provided for the attorney general to recover attorney's fees in a case when the state is entitled to recover a penalty. That's section 402.006 of the government code. And so we see in 1995 we have a public cause of action, we have a provision for recovery of attorney's fees, and then in 2001, rather than that scheme of enforcement, we're shifting to a private cause of action, and in that private cause of action, we're going to recover liquidated damages that don't abate upon the death of the person involved, and we're providing for reasonable attorney's fees.
So if the attorney general can enforce this, it's too late, right?
That would be our position, is it's too late.
I assume so. So your interpretation has the beneficial effect that you won't pay any penalty.
That would be our hope. The third reason that we believe there's no private cause of action in this instance.
Let me ask you this. Who is harmed by the failure to deliver the deed?
In the facts of this case, no one.
Well, but I mean, generically, it's the promisee, isn't it?
Potentially, the promisee could be harmed.
The individual's harmed.
Yes.
And if the attorney general collects a penalty, where does that money go?
That penalty, in the absence of legislative language saying where it goes, would go to the state.
And so there's no redress to the party who's harmed under your scenario?
That's not correct. The party who's harmed has all of the old common law and statutory causes of action that they had prior to 1995. There could well be fraud in a real estate transaction. There could be breach of contract actions, there could be DTPA actions, and there could be common law fraud actions. So the person who does not receive the deed timely has an action and has a wide panoply of actions to pursue to recover all of his damages, and in many instances, attorney's fees in addition to those damages. So permitting that person to recover $250 a day for 90 days and then $500 a day thereafter.
But conversely, permitting the state of Texas to recover money for an injury it did not suffer is equally absurd, isn't it?
I think that the reason for the penalty in the first place is to coerce the seller to provide the deed. One of the things the legislature was dealing with in 1995 was some developers would sell the same piece of property on a contract for deed to many people. And what the legislature was trying to deal with was the instance where the seller entered into a contract, had that contract paid off, and only then did the buyer find out the seller can't convey title to me. Either he's placed a lien on my property in the meantime or prior to that, and the lien hasn't been paid off, so I can't get clear title. He sold my property to more than one person, so he can't convey property, can't convey title to me. Those are the things that the state was dealing with. And one of the provisions in the statute in 1995 was a requirement to file these contracts in the deed records of the county involved. There's no penalty for failure to do that, but what the legislature obviously was getting at was we want to make sure that when you pay off your property, the buyer is going to either have a tremendous problem with the state in terms of these penalties, or you're going to get title to your property. In this case, the facts are that Mr. Brown always had the ability to convey title. There were never any liens on this property, and there was no prohibition from him transferring that title.
We're looking in these statutes for clues, and you've already mentioned legislative history, but the Court of Appeals get a survey of other statutes in which the Attorney General is both authorized to file suit and to collect a penalty. Why shouldn't we say that when the legislature intends for the state to be able to sue and collect the money, it says so? When it doesn't, it doesn't. In this case, there's an omission. It doesn't say the AG can collect the penalty or file suit. And in the absence of that, that, you know, if there's no remedy by a private party, then the statute is meaningless.
There are several answers to that. The most important answer is when you focus on whether or not the state can enforce the cause of action to determine whether or not there was legislative intent to create a private cause of action, you're starting down the road of a non sequitur. The absence of a state cause of action is not legislative intent of a private cause of action. Our Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court in 2001, said this about private causes of action. It says, in the absence of legislative intent to create a private cause of action, a cause of action does not exist. Number one, does not exist, and courts may not create one. Number two, no matter how desirable that might be as a policy matter or how compatible with the statute. So I say that in answer to your question, the first question is there express language in the statute that creates a private cause of action?
Of course, you said they do have a cause of action. What we're really looking at is whether to imply an additional penalty, not a new cause of action. Cause of action is already there.
But there is no private cause of action. There's no cause of action available to the buyer.
If they don't give it to you, they've got a private cause of action. You just told Judge O'Neill that. Breach of contract.
Well, that's correct.
So
that's correct.
All we're talking about is whether we should imply an additional penalty.
That's correct. Now, in the context of whether or not the state can do this, we have in this court's opinion in El Paso Electric Company versus State Board of Insurance, you set out very clearly that there is this hierarchy of law enforcement officers that represent the state. The Attorney General represents the state in trial courts in some instances, and in instances where he does not, then the county attorney and the district attorney represent the state. The Court of Appeals decision in this case goes off on whether or not Justice McClure could find specific authorization for the Attorney General, and even though she notes in her opinion that the county attorney and district attorney likewise have constitutional and statutory authority to represent the state, that just goes out of the opinion. She says, I can't find it for the Attorney General, therefore it must be a private cause of action. And Alexander versus Sandoval, the 2001 United States Supreme Court case, says if you can't find legislative intent to create that private cause of action, it doesn't exist and you can't create it. You have to find it either in the express language of the statute or in the legislative history of the statute involved.
Counsel, since you cite the U.S. Supreme Court, that court has also recognized that in certain contexts that there's the concept of a private attorney's general that helps the state pursue a public policy objective and help correct a problem, particularly in RICO cases, certain civil rights actions. The U.S. Supreme Court has referred to private attorneys general who help enforce a policy objective by being able to sue individually. Why is that reasoning or that type of analogy not compelling in this case for the 1995 statute, such that the attorney general and private individuals could both help satisfy a public policy objective in the colonies?
Well, I think, first of all, it's true that if there is a public cause of action, there's no private cause of action without a specific language in the statute. However, we have an instance in Texas. The Deceptive Trade Practices Act happened to be enacted as I was graduating from law school, and I recall at that time a lot of discussion, David Bragg, Phil Maxwell, and those sorts of people saying we're creating private attorneys general. And in that statute, what we see is a clear delineation of who it is that can seek to enforce the penalties there, because we have automatic trebling of damages then, and a provision for attorney's fees. In this statute, we do not have any indication of who the person is who can enforce it, if anyone, and there's no provision for attorney's fees.
Well, which way does that cut, counsel? Neither does the statute expressly say that the state or the attorney general can pursue this claim. There's no express language either direction.
I beg to differ with you, Your Honor, and I've got to go back to 1892 in a United States Supreme Court case that says that strictly and primarily the language penalty denotes punishment, whether corporal or pecuniary, imposed and enforced by the state. Now, I haven't found anything since then.
That's from the U.S. Supreme Court.
From the U.S. Supreme Court. That's Huntington versus Attrell, 146 U.S. 657 at 667. And it goes on to talk about...
That was for a public harm. And I think you said that the harm here is to the individual.
No, ma'am. I think the harm here potentially is to the individual. This individual in this case suffered no harm. Zero. No inconvenience.
No, I understand, but in terms of the import of the statutory scheme with the penalty is to rectify an individual harm. And I believe that case that you just cited involved a harm to the public, didn't it?
I'm not sure of what it... once I see 1892, it kind of... But it did have the only explanation, the only definition of what penalty meant in terms of public versus private.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Anthony C. Aguilar will present argument
for the respondent. May it please the court. As Mr. Thompson said, in 1995, Senators Ross and Trone and Representative Olivera submitted legislation to amend Chapter 5 of the Property Code. As Senator Rawson stated at a committee hearing, she said that the purpose of the bill was a consumer protection bill.
Are you aware of any other private cause of action where you get $250 to $500 a day?
Not the only one that I know of, Your Honor, is if you get into the routine of the fraudulent liens now, you can get the greater of actual damages are $10,000. Now, say you have no damages, the statute says you're entitled to $10,000.
But this $250 a day penalty, that looks like a contempt of court penalty, doesn't it?
Well, initially what happened was...
Just have you ever seen it anywhere else other than a contempt of court?
Your Honor, in my brief, I cited some where they have penalties for, I believe, shareholders and condominiums, whatever. I don't remember off the top of my head.
This is a $250 a day going up to $500 a day, and you think they do that to condominium owners?
I think I cited some statute, Your Honor, in my brief. I can't tell you right off the top of my head.
I mean, the most often that's done in contempt of court cases. That's the main place we see it.
I admit to you that is
and in contempt of court cases, who gets those penalties?
In contempt of court cases, the state does, or the county does. Senator Rawson turned around and submitted the bill, and initially the bill had two sections that would allow the purchaser to recover penalties in the event the seller failed to do things. Those sections were 5.100 and 5.102. 5.100 stated that the purchaser, if they were not given the annual accounting statement, could automatically deduct 15% of the payments until they turned around and got the items. Then 5.102 said that the purchaser was supposed to be given the deed within 30 days after the final payment. Now, if you read 5.102 isolated, you say, well, are you sure that the purchaser is the one who's entitled to enforce the penalty? My comeback on that is, if you read the whole statute only deals with two entities, seller and purchaser. If purchaser fails to do certain things, seller has remedies to take the property back. If seller fails to do certain things, then purchaser has remedies. And one of those remedies underneath that statute was, initially, a penalty of the daily rate, which the legislature changed to the $250 a day and then $500 a day after 90 days. And if you read the whole statute in context, the attorney general is never mentioned. The one who's supposed to be given the right for the penalties is the purchaser if the seller fails to comply with terms and conditions. Now, this is no different. Mr. Brown had in his contract under paragraph 6.3 a provision that said, I will give you the deed within 30 days after the final payment. And he didn't give it to him. Now, the legislature came in and said, we want the seller to give recorded legal title before this provision is enforced. The reason for that is very, very simple. One, the initial deal said title vested in the purchaser upon final payment. Well, how are you going to have any title policy or anything else on that? So they came in and said recorded legal title. The reason being that there wouldn't be a dispute as to whether or not the title was given. In this case, it gets to be interesting because Mr. Brown and what he calls his replacement warranty deed says, well, this is to replace a deed I think I gave to De La Cruz in June of 97, when in fact there was no deed.
Do you agree that the purchasers have no actual damages in this situation?
Yes, sir. I do. Candidly, the thing in this case that was a bit of a problem was that so much time had passed. Now, admittedly, Mr. De La Cruz could have incurred expenses possibly for a breach of contract. Don't think he could have done it underneath deceptive trade. Three, there had been no way to get the deed from Mr. Brown, and candidly, we wanted to get his undivided attention and get the deed. And this statute was there, and it was passed by the legislature. Now, what is bad from a practical viewpoint is that the lawsuit was filed 3.5 years after the final payment. And then Mr. Brown took another month, 2.5 months to give the deed. I don't think that the legislature ever contemplated that a seller would let something like this drag on for 3.5, almost 4 years.
Didn't your client let it drag on too, just as long as we're talking about the fact?
Admittedly, yes, sir. My client is basically an uneducated person that buys property underneath the contract to sell, Your Honor. And he didn't know any of the laws, didn't know anything. He just wanted his deed. And a lawsuit was filed. 2.5 months later, he gets his deed. So, yes, but you have to put everybody in their categories. As Mr. Thompson says, Mr. Brown had agents, evidently had attorneys, was sophisticated in this, had done things. My client's an uneducated man. Didn't know at all. But the attorney general says that underneath certain circumstances, the rate of the penalty or the amount of the fine per day can be considered a reasonable compensation for failure to get the deed. But my client wasn't out any money, I admit that. After this lawsuit was filed, the Texas legislature amended 5.100 and 5.102. And I go back to the Stanford v. Butler case, which is 181 Southwest 2nd, 269. It's a 1944 case. This court cited it in the Texas Water Commission versus Brushy Creek case in 1996. It says, if you have a latter amendment in all of a statute, that's highly persuasive as to the intention of the legislature and the prior thing, and the prior statute. The reason that it was amended was essentially that there were some problems in Fort Worth after the tornadoes, and Senator Moncrief wanted to turn around and extend the coverage of the statute. So there were two changes, dramatic changes in it. One, they took and redesignated 5.100 to 5.077. And in that, instead of the purchaser being able to get the 15% automatically, just by himself, they put in that the seller was subject to civil damages in the amount of $250 a day. So they put that specifically in there. Then they came down and redesignated 5.102 to 5.079 and put it that the civil damages were payable to the purchaser. So I submit to Your Honor, if you take the subsequent statute and read it and relate it back, they always intended for this to be a private cause of action.
It looks the opposite. It looks like, why change it if they weren't trying to make it private when it wasn't private before?
I think they were trying to clarify, and I think they were
trying
to have.
That's the problem we always have. Amendment, we can't tell if it's a clarification or a change.
Well, I don't argue with that, Judge. What I think happened was Senator Moncrief took and put 5.077 in. And 5.077 talked about civil damages and the $250 a day. And for clarification purposes, since the other penalty section, remedial section for the purchaser, was 5.079, he put the same language in that. Now, when you come to the...
Don't you think that liable for liquidated damages certainly sounds a whole lot more like a private cause of action than penalty?
Sure. I have no argument there. One of the problems with this statute, as far as I'm concerned, is the phraseology. I admit to you that I prefer civil damages over penalties. I admit that. But if you go back and you look at the history, they had to be referring, whenever they use the phrase penalties, to recovery by the purchaser. Now, whether or not, and we're not here for that, whether or not the penalties are excessive or not, that's for another day. The question we have is, can the purchaser bring the private cause of action?
Are there any defenses to the statutory claim?
Not underneath 5.102. Justice O'Neill, what they did is in 5.079, they brought up affirmative defenses, and they gave them affirmative defenses, and 5.079 allowed the recovery of attorney fees, as did 5.077. The prior thing, 5.100, concerning the remedies for failure to give the annual accounting, didn't have attorney fees either. All it said was, purchaser, if you don't get it, deduct 15% and you're fine.
I guess what I'm asking is, under the old statute that we're operating under, would latches, estoppel, would those sort of defenses be available?
I don't think so. That was a question that was asked by the Court of Appeals. And I don't, unless they wanted to give the defenses, affirmative defenses, then it should be stated. Now, one of the things that happened procedurally in this case that the Court of Appeals couldn't handle was the fact that Mr. Brown amended his summary judgment and didn't discuss the affirmative defenses. So we're stuck in a problem. That's why they're remanding it, or said they wanted to remand it to the trial court, because we were going to have to deal with whether or not the affirmative defenses apply. But the question...
And you agree with that?
That it should be remanded?
Yeah.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, Justice Heck. I mean,
you know, they haven't been raised here. They weren't raised in the Court of Appeals, so they'd have to come out.
Right. I think that really what we had to do, and the way this case was set up was, we set it up so that we came up on appeal on, is there a private cause of action? Yes or no? Then if there is a private cause of action, whenever it goes back, then we have certain other questions. It may be that the trial court or the appellate court or this court says common law affirmative defenses apply. We don't know that because that was never presented to the appellate court and it was never presented to the trial court. But all the statute is, and we have other statutes, all the statute is a self-policing statute. There's two people involved, seller and purchaser. And we can have self-policing statutes. For example, this court wrote the opinion on Ostenberg versus Pekka, where Judge Pekka sued Ostenberg for civil damages underneath the election code. And there was a discussion in there about the Ragsdale versus Progressive Voters League case, where it says sometimes it's beneficial to write statutes that are self-policing. And this is self-policing. How is the Attorney General ever going to know whether or not or when a contract of sale is paid off?
Somebody complains.
Pardon?
Somebody complains.
Well, for the Attorney General, though, just somebody, they don't have a system set up to keep
track. I know, but somebody calls and says, hey, I can't get my deed.
Well, that may be. That may be. But what's the difference of the individual and a self-policing statute coming in and saying, well, I'm going to file the lawsuit to try to get my deed and get my money? If there's penalties or damages.
Because when they go to a lawyer, the lawyer's going to want to be paid out of that money they're going to get, right?
Well, I'm being paid
Attorney General's not going to charge them for attorney's fees. When they go to a lawyer, the lawyer's going to want 40% of this $250 a day, probably, before the statute was amended, right?
They could.
So which one are they better off going to?
They're better off going to whomever's going to move their case the fastest to get them the items back. And if it's a situation that it's better to go to the attorney general under those circumstances, fine. If it's better to go to a private attorney, that's fine. In this case, because the attorney general has never brought any case underneath this statute, I would say it's better to go to a private attorney.
Have any private attorneys ever brought a case under the statute?
Well.
Except you.
Pardon?
Yeah. Except you.
Well, I'm just saying, Your Honor, that the statute's
working.
Yeah, the statute's working. Candidly, it worked really well because after we filed the lawsuit, Mr. De La Cruz did get his deed. I admit to you, it took 2.5 months after the lawsuit was filed, and it took almost 4 years after he made the last payment. But the statute worked. It worked the way the legislature intended it to work.
Under the statute, the calculation of damages was about $660,000. Is that correct?
The statutory penalties is $664,500.
And the original principal value of the transaction was $13,000.
My client paid, including interest, $26,054.
That's why I asked about the original principal value.
The principal balance was $13,500.
What's the total amount of the award now with interest? Do you know?
Well, since the legislature changed the interest rate effective September 1, for anything signed, any judgment signed after September 1, and it's a floating rate, I can't answer the interest. If you figure out the penalties up to the date in which Mr. De La Cruz received the deed, it was $664,500. And then there is a question if underneath this circumstance he's entitled to prejudgment interest or not. And what is the rate, because we changed everything, it's floating rate.
If we put to the side the arguments that you're making that you believe are logical and how to apply the statute generally, and just look at the facts of this case, it seems like a very unusual case for there to be over $600,000 in damages for a $13,000 principal transaction. Doesn't that seem to be out of kilter?
No, because the Texas legislature said that's the way they wanted to do it. If Mr. Brown had paid...
If your argument's correct.
Your Honor, if Mr. Brown had paid, given the deed in the 30 days, there's no damages, no penalties, zero. If he had given it on the 31st day, it was $250. The only reason it is so high is that Mr. Brown, not Mr. De La Cruz, Mr. Brown did not comply with the statute, did not comply with the contract. Did not give the recorded legal title until the end of March 2001. So any penalties and the accrual of the penalties is not due to Mr. De La Cruz, it's due to Mr. Brown on a daily basis refusing to give the recorded deed. Now,
and you've been candid in acknowledging that your client suffered no actual damages.
My client had no actual damages. I'm not arguing with that. But I am trying to point out that whatever is paid to Mr. De La Cruz in this situation is not technically, well, he will benefit, but it's not technically a benefit to him. It's more of a punishment to Mr. Brown for not complying with the statute.
Well, I mean, admittedly, it wasn't as though he were trying to withhold the deed. I mean, there was a request by Ms. De La Cruz to include her name on the deed, which didn't comply with the contract. So there was some confusion, and it just appears the ball got dropped. I mean, there was no fraud or misfeasance or malfeasance, I suppose I should say, on Mr. Brown's part. You'd agree with that.
Ms. De La Cruz went to Mr. Guillen and to Mr. Cargill, and laying aside the question of unlawful practice of law, they knew that the item had been paid. At that time, sure, she was over there trying to get her name on the deed. I admit that. But they knew at that juncture that they had to give the deed to Mr. De La Cruz. I mean, they were the agents of Mr. Brown. They handled everything for him. All they had to do, regardless of the confusion, is just give a deed, a recorded legal title, to Arturo De La Cruz, and then the wife and he could do whatever they were going to do. But at least there would have been compliance by Mr. Brown. There was no compliance. And there was no compliance by Mr. Brown even for 2.5 months after the lawsuit was filed. And if you get sued for $600,000, I would think that would get someone's undivided attention to promptly comply with the statute. It took 2.5 months. So I submit that it's not a situation of necessarily Mr. De La Cruz being compensated, if you want. It's more of a penalty to Mr. Brown for not doing what he's supposed to do. same as speeding. You can speed every day and get a ticket every day, and they just keep on adding up. They just keep on adding up. You do it every day, you get one, you get another one, you get another one. Eventually, it's going to get real high, and that's what happened in this case, and that's what makes it unusual. But I submit to you that if the Attorney General wants to turn around and bring another lawsuit underneath the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, I don't think the Court of Appeals was saying that they couldn't do that. What the Court of Appeals was talking about was, could the Attorney General bring a lawsuit underneath 5.102? And their whole statement on it was, obviously not. We did not get into discussion with the Court of Appeals concerning grafting the Deceptive Trade Practices Act over and allowing the Attorney General to come in and sue underneath that because of a violation of 5.102. That was never presented. So whenever you read the Court of Appeals opinion concerning the Attorney General not being able to bring the cause of action, they're talking about the Attorney General underneath 5.102.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the amicus.
May it please the court, Mr. R. Ted Cruz will present argument for amicus curiae in the state of Texas.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the best and most direct way for the court to address this question is as a simple matter of statutory interpretation. There is no doubt that the statute in question, the former provision of the property code, is ambiguous. This case would be far simpler if it specified on its face either that the Attorney General could bring an action or that a private cause of action existed. But that
it's got to be one or the other. I mean, the legislature would not set up this detailed a scheme with no enforcement mechanism at all.
We agree that the statute has to mean something. It is conceivable it could be both. There are statutory provisions where the legislature, such as the DTPA, decides to allow both a public and private suit. But we agree that this court must strive to ascribe some meaning to the text of what the legislature passed. And what we would submit, the best meaning that can be given to the words that were passed by the legislature, in the absence of a specification one way or another, who collects this penalty? But the best meaning is that the phrase subject to a penalty yields an inference that penalty is a penalty on behalf of the state brought by the Attorney General. The El Paso Court of Appeals, in analyzing this question, engaged in an improper and artificial temporal dichotomy. It was a two-step analysis where first the Court of Appeals asked, is the Attorney General authorized to bring an action? Since the Attorney General was not mentioned in the statute, the Court of Appeals concluded no, and it then engaged in a second step and said, well, if the AG isn't, somebody must be, therefore a private cause of action exists. That bifurcation is not the correct way to approach it. And it's a fairly simple matter to flip the order of consideration, ask, is there a private cause of action? No. Therefore, the AG must be able to bring it. And I would say that's the wrong way to approach it as well. The right way to approach it is to look at the language the legislature passed and ask, what is the best and most consistent interpretation this court can give that effectuates the intent of the legislature? And the most natural inference from the use of the phrase subject to a penalty with no additional indicia of an outside enforcement mechanism is that that penalty would go to the state.
Why does subject to a penalty mean state instead of private actor?
It doesn't necessarily. And in other cases, the legislature has used penalty with respect to allowing a private cause of action. But in those cases, it is specified a private cause of action will lie for this penalty.
How many other statutes are there like this one that don't say one way or the other?
From the briefing that's been done, there is only one other statute that's been identified in that. And we have not engaged in a more comprehensive examination. We're not aware of any additional ones. But in this case, there isn't a specification of who can bring it.
And are there other statutes where you get X number of dollars per day?
There are.
And are those the ones on page 17 in the respondent's brief or somewhere where an individual gets X number of dollars a day?
Petitioner's reply brief does a very nice job of breaking out a series of statutes, both those where the legislature specifies, use the word penalty, and specifies that it goes to the state, which is the more usual formulation, and also those where it's used the word penalty and specified it's a private cause of action.
wouldn't allowing both public and private actors to pursue this claim perhaps expedite the public policy objective here?
Send
a stronger message?
It could well, and that's a policy determination. The Attorney General's office does not take a position on whether or not a private cause of action exists under this statute. The court asked our opinion on whether the Attorney General could enforce it, and we're here today to say yes, the Attorney General could enforce it. And to note additionally that although in the past the Attorney General's office has not brought actions under either the old or new statute, that we're currently investigating both the facts at issue in this case and also the facts implicated in the class action suit that was referenced in the amicus brief that was filed. I would note with one correction to our brief, we stated in our footnote that there had been no actions under the new statute. And the Consumer Protection Division has since discovered last night, actually, that we do have one pending action. That is the State of Texas versus Sun City Investments, which is pending in El Paso County Court, which is a DTPA suit where we have included an additional claim for the penalty. Now, that's under the new statute, but that is one pending action that we do have. It's currently in discovery. It's in an early stage of litigation, and we did not encounter it in our initial search. An additional source to buttress the inference that subject to a penalty yields the natural interpretation that goes to the state is Texas Government Code Section 402.006C, which provides that in a case in which the state is entitled to recover a penalty, the Attorney General is entitled on behalf of the state to reasonable attorney's fees and court costs. And that's yet another basic indicium of the background norm, the penalties, when the legislature uses that term, it is typically thinking of a penalty that will go to the state. In addition to the statutory interpretation mechanism, which we think is the most straightforward and direct way for the court to address this question, we think there are two alternative bases of authority that are possible. The first is not directly relevant to the facts of this case, but were the defendant a corporation, we believe the Attorney General would have authority under the Texas Constitution directly to bring an action. And secondly, under the DTPA, the Attorney General also, we believe, would have the authority to bring an action. Now, we would note that with respect to the new statute is markedly different from the old. The new statute plainly provides a private cause of action. And so, as a matter of statutory interpretation, we do not suggest that the Attorney General could bring an action to collect the new statute. Although the case I just referenced is a very good example of how the DTPA can work in concert with the new statute, where we can bring a DTPA action, and the DTPA allows for the collection of actual damages, which now under the new statute, damages are specified as liquidated damages. And so that's how we're litigating that case. That's how we believe that the new statute would operate.
What is the Attorney General's view of private attorney generals and applying those into statutes?
That is certainly a tool that is available to the legislature, and there are instances where it has chosen to rely upon them. The DTPA is one. The new statute is another. One reason why the Office of Attorney General, when we examined our records, we could not find in the past actions under this property code is there have been relatively few complaints that the office has received in the history of this statute about the failure to deliver deed. We've brought a number of cases focusing on colonias. Colonias remains a very high priority of the legislature and of Attorney General Abbott. And in the past 15 years, we've obtained judgments in 50 cases, approximately 50 cases, impacting thousands of colonias and focusing primarily on actual improvements that improve the lives of residents, that yield the provision of water, the provision of sewage systems, the provision of platting. And we've collected hundreds of thousands in penalties. And we have right now enforcement litigation pending in five counties concerning colonias. In Hidalgo, Star, Maverick, Frio, and El Paso County, we have actions pending in all five. So it remains a high priority of the office. But it may well be that given the lack of actions that have been brought in the past, that may have been one of the reasons the legislature chose to make this explicitly a private cause of action with attorney's fees, is the thought that that might yield a greater incentive for individuals to come forth and relate facts that would support an action. And if there are no further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to use my time responding to some questions that were not asked of me. Justice Hecht, you asked, was this a clarification or a change? The rather than language would indicate this is a change. The new provision for attorney's fees would indicate this is a change. The change of terminology from penalties, which abate, to liquidated damages, which do not, is a change. And perhaps the most important change is when the statute was passed, or amended in 2001, it was given prospective use only. If this was simply a clarification, then it seems the legislature would say the substantive part of this, the penalty part of this, the dollars part, applies to all actions, irrespective of when filed, because after all, we're simply clarifying what has always been the law. They didn't do that. They said this new regime only applies to causes of action filed after 2001.
Is there any indication that this lawsuit was the impetus for the change in the legislation?
No, as a matter of fact, there's an indication it was not. What brought the change in this statute in its entirety was the tornado that went through downtown Fort Worth. Senator Moncrief was outraged at some of the abuses that he saw in contract for deed transactions in the Linwood subdivision in Fort Worth, and the primary one there was the sellers requiring insurance on houses that were built. The houses were destroyed by the tornado, and the seller got the insurance proceeds rather than the buyer, the person building the property. That outraged Senator Moncrief and the rest of the legislature, and we see that some of the penalties, some of the liquidated damages provisions increased substantially as a result of that. But there's no indication that this lawsuit had anything to do with that change. Justice O'Neill, you asked, was there a public benefit involved here? There that were identified in Section 1 of Senate Bill 336, and I'd like to go through those very quickly and tell you what the legislative response was to those evils. The first one was that the statutory law in the state does not ensure that information about the property was being conveyed to the buyer. There was no requirement to tell them about utility service, whether the property is located in a floodplain, whether the title of the property is encumbered by a lien. None of that had to be disclosed by the seller. The legislative response to that evil was Section 5.094, Seller's Disclosure of Property Conditions. That provision says if you don't give these disclosures, that can be enforced as a public or private action under the DTPA. So we have a private cause of action established for the remedy for that evil. Under Cole versus Huntsville Hospital, the establishment of a private cause of action for that evil and no private cause of action for the evil involved in our case is an indication the legislature did not intend a private cause of action. The second evil was there was no statutory requirement for the contract to be recorded to notify subsequent creditors of the purchaser's interest in the property. The current provision for that is found in Section 5.076 on recording requirements. There is no cause of action, public or private, for that. The legislature simply said, you have to do this. The third evil was that legal title to the property is transferred by the purchaser to the purchaser by the seller when the purchaser has paid all amounts due under the contract. No statutory requirement compelling that. 5.102 was the response to that. 5.102 does not contain a private cause of action type of language that we see in 5.094. And the last evil identified in Section 1 of Senate Bill 336 is that the purchaser's equity in the property had to be protected, and the current protections in the 2001 statute are found in 5.064, 65, and 66 on when you can foreclose on a contract for deed situation. What we see is that initially, my time has expired. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call and concludes today's oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.